One of the people who heard this clarion call was David Ben-Gurion, the future founding prime minister of Israel, but at this time 10 years old and living in Plansk. And he later recalled that a rumor spread that the Messiah had arrived, a tall, handsome man, a learned man of Vienna, a doctor no less, Theodor Herzl.
Dr. Palisar, as we ended the previous lecture, you're helping to remind us about the role that anti-Semitism played in the writing of the Jewish state. I think we should begin, as we get ready for the next lecture in this series, to just ask you to help us preview some of the other ideas that Herzl will describe in the book.
Well, the book really can be divided into two parts. There's a part that makes the case why a Jewish state is both necessary and desirable, but the main part of the book, at least in terms of number of words and depth of argument, is actually the steps needed to build the Jewish state. And so I'll take each of those in turn. The argument for the Jewish state is an argument that stems in large part from anti-Semitism, which Herzl saw as something that wasn't going to go away ever. It was just an intrinsic part of the way people related to Jews always had, and in his view, always would.
And this he describes the Jewish question.
Right. For him, the Jewish question really was how to deal with anti-Semitism. There are a lot of Jewish questions you could ask. You could ask, how have the Jews been so successful in getting their ideas out? Why has this people survived for so long? What are the conditions that most naturally lead to Jewish thriving? But for Herzl, the overriding Jewish question was, what do you do to end the seemingly nonstop persecution and degradation of this ancient people? So he begins with that question. He explains that anti-Semitism is a permanent feature, and he considers the two alternatives. Either we stay or we go. Well, we can't stay because anti-Semitism isn't going to get any better. If we go, there are two choices. Either we go to a country that doesn't currently have anti-Semitism, where we'll be a minority, but in Herzl's view, that always fails, because either you go there and you're not successful, in which case it was a bad enterprise, or you go there and you begin to succeed, and then you import anti-Semitism as a result of jealousy. And so, almost by process of elimination, he's left with one alternative, which is move to our own country where we can build our own state and prosper and be free of this demon of anti-Semitism. So from there, he traces the three key parts of the move to the Promised Land. And at this point, he's not sure whether that Promised Land is Israel or it's a country like Argentina, which is the example that he gives. So he takes those three in turn. The first one is the Company of Jews, and they're doing incredibly complicated, difficult work. They're picking up millions of people in one place and moving them to a different country with the goal of not causing dislocation in the countries where those Jews had lived, but giving them a better life in the country to which they do live, or to which they are moving. And so that requires a whole series of economic things. There are sections on workmen's dwellings and on real estate purchases and on corporate stock and in a whole host of other such things.
So Herzl comes to the conclusion that it's necessary to found a state, a sovereign political entity. And yet the first mechanism he describes to advance the project of that founding is not a political entity at all. It's this commercial company that you're describing. Why does he do that? What problem does that solve?
Well, so actually, Herzl acknowledges that, logically speaking, we should begin with the Society of Jews, which is precisely a political entity. It's an entity that's going to unite the Jews, ascertain once and for all, do they want to move, and if so, to where, and then negotiate with the leading powers in the world in order to secure, by international agreement, a territory on which the Jews can build that state. And yet, nonetheless, he puts that at the end. And he only explains briefly why he does, but I think his rationale is, I'll probably be able to convince a lot of readers that this makes sense, and that if Jews were united, there might be a way to represent the Jewish people. But it just seems intractably difficult. So I want to start by showing that I have the answers. It's actually very interesting. It harkens back to his conversation with Baron Hirsch. And Baron Hirsch had been concerned that Herzl hadn't figured out all of the necessary steps. And Herzl wanted to tell him, but it's all here. It's in these notes. I know it's transportation and it's money and it's logistics. And I really have figured it out. And I think that same urge was telling me, had to let his readers know, yes, there are a lot of steps, but between my logic, technology, Jewish know-how, and the interest that the rest of the world has in helping us, we really can get all of it solved. So I think only once he had put that to bed, at least as well as he knew how to put it to bed, in the first of his practical chapters, did he feel that he could then move on to the broader, more conceptual areas.
There is this precedent of chartered companies that other political entities had developed, and that Herzl thought that would be useful for initiating a kind of settlement in the land of Israel.
That cuts to a broader strategy that Herzl had. At the beginning of the Jewish state, he explains, nothing in here is new. All of these are ideas you already have. The idea of restoring a Jewish state, you already have. And he wanted to extend that same principle to his means of solution. So one other example before I touch on the point you raise, he wants to make the case for why this society of Jews can represent the Jewish people. But instead of just saying, look, we're scattered all over the earth, we've got to figure out some way to make a decision, let's bring together a group of people and that people will then represent us, he goes to a part of Roman law, which presumably he had learned as a student at the University of Vienna Law School, the gestor or gestor, depending which kind of Latin you want to pronounce, and he wants to show my political ideas also come from elsewhere. So I think it's the same thing. He's setting up this company. There was at this point a history of chartered companies. I think the British East India Company would be the most famous example, but there were certainly others. And he wanted to say, this isn't the first time that something as technical and economic as a company can do things that are of enormous significance internationally. The British East India Company had literally tens of thousands of soldiers. It had ambassadors. It had many of the functions of not only a sovereign state, but a sovereign empire. And I think he was trying to hearken to that tradition.
Something that would incubate the institutions of a state before a political settlement could be reached.
Right. And again, it's a dual activity. You have the company of the Jews, the Jewish company, and you have the society of the Jews. And each one of these was meant to incubate different kinds of institutions that ultimately would set up the state. Remember, he had said that this is a process that for Moses took 40 years to lead the Jews through the desert. We'll need at least 20 or 30. And as I'll be speaking about in a later lecture, he at some point says it's going to take 50 years. So when you're playing the long game, you think about institutions. So you think about, we need to build the institutions before we even have the state so that we're ready to run a state. Part of this is an objection, and a very reasonable objection was the Jews aren't ready for sovereignty. We haven't had experience with it for 2,000 years. And what he's telling his readers is, fair enough, but we're going to have a warm-up period. We're going to have a chance where we build these institutions, we learn statecraft, and we won't be fully sovereign until we're ready for it. We are a people, one people, Theodor Herzl declared in the introduction to Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, published in February of 1896. It's a simple statement, quite obvious to most of us, at least today, but at the time that statement was made, it was a rallying cry on the one hand, but it was deeply frightening to that entire project of emancipationist Western Jewry who had wanted to prove precisely that we are not a people, one people, but rather I'm of the French people and he's of the German people and she's of the English people and each of us belongs to a different people. We're Jewish by religion, but not by nationality. So, on the one hand, this was in many respects the most frightening part of the book, as it was read by many in Western Europe. But in Eastern Europe, this really struck home. If we think back to the first lecture talking about that small number of assets that Herzl or anybody would have as he was stepping up to try to launch a Jewish state, one of those assets was this two millennia long sense that had somehow survived through prayers, through Bible, through dreams, through furtive looks Jews gave one another as they spoke about what had been and what could be once again. That Jewish nationalism was awakened by this cry of, we are a people, one people. Now Herzl had built up to this during the preface to Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, in which he had three key points. First, our aim is to restore the Jewish state, nothing less. Second, this is not a new idea, he assured his readers. Everything you are going to see here are ideas that have come before. These are all things that we know. I'm just putting it together in one place. And third and finally, he said, this is eminently practical if all of you take this up. As he put it, the Jews who wish for a state shall have it, and they will deserve to have it. And in those lines, he made it clear that he had abandoned his earlier idea, which we discussed in the last lecture, that this was a dream that could be brought about if he could find and persuade the right person, whether that was a Baron Hirsch, or whether that was the Rothschild family, or whether that was a Bismarck. No, he was now declaring, this was a project that was feasible if and only if the Jewish people as a whole were to take it on as their project. What we are going to do today is to continue from that point in the introduction, this point of we are a people, one people, and we're going to continue studying together through the end of the book and in the same spirit that we did in the previous lecture. This is a great book. It's a really beautifully written, cogently argued text. Yes, it has its holes. Yes, there are parts of it that predicted things that didn't come true, but on the whole, it is a remarkably accurate, prophetic, and profoundly moving book. So rather than paraphrasing, I will quote fairly liberally and interpret as I go along. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to read and discuss every single word in this book, although I very much wish we could. We'll make do with the with representative parts that I hope get across the sense of the whole. When we're done looking at the book's text, we're then going to consider briefly how it addressed the triple challenge of launching a Jewish state: the intellectual challenge of persuading people that it was desirable and feasible, the political institutional challenge of building the organization that could bring this thing about through international action carried out over a long period of time, and the diplomatic task of bringing one or more of the great powers to acknowledge that it was necessary to create this Jewish state and to take the actions to create it. Once we've done that, we're going to consider what impact this slim volume had on the Jewish world, and to a certain extent the non-Jewish world, and what dilemmas Herzl, as the leader, or the soon-to-be leader of this new movement, was going to face in the wake of its publication. So an ambitious amount to cover, and let's dig right in. Immediately after these words, we are a people, one people, Herzl explained, why was this the case? Why was it necessary for the Jews to remain as one people? Why couldn't they do what so many of them wanted to do, which is to become a part of the broader world, each in his or her own country? And here's what he wrote. We have honestly endeavored everywhere to merge ourselves in the social life of surrounding communities and to preserve the faith of our fathers. We are not permitted to do this. In vain are we loyal patriots, our loyalty in some places running to extremes. In vain do we make the same sacrifices of life and property as our fellow citizens. In vain do we strive to increase the fame of our native land in science and art, or her wealth by trade and commerce. In countries where we have lived for centuries, we are still cried down as strangers, and often by those whose ancestors were not yet domiciled in the land where Jews had already had experience of suffering. What Herzl is saying to all those who want to assimilate, to become part of the surrounding countries, is it won't work. It doesn't matter if this is your fondest dream or your worst nightmare. Whatever we try to do to become part of those around us, they reject us time after time. So we are a people, one people. You can be excited about it, or you can feel that it's imposed on us by others, but it is the reality with which we live. And anti-Semitism wouldn't be cured, therefore, by staying in the countries that Jews lived in at that time. But as a proud Jew, he couldn't go too many lines just with this negativity, and he actually points out the beneficial effects on the Jewish people of anti-Semitism. Oppression and persecution cannot exterminate us. No nation on earth has survived such struggles and sufferings as we have gone through. Jew baiting has merely stripped off our weaklings. The strong among us were invariably true to their race when persecution broke out against them. Classic late 19th century social Darwinism. The fact that we have been under these great pressures has, in a certain sense, strengthened us. And that same pride evident in those lines bursts forth shortly after in these words. The distinctive nationality of Jews neither can, will, nor must be destroyed. It cannot be destroyed because external enemies consolidated. It will not be destroyed. This is shown during 2,000 years of appalling suffering. It must not be destroyed, and that, as a descendant of numberless Jews who refuse to despair, I am trying once more to prove in this pamphlet. Whole branches of Judaism may wither and fall, but the trunk will remain. I think the traditional Jews reading these lines surely heard in their heads, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. The Eternal of Israel does not go back on his word. The Eternal of Israel is faithful. The Jewish people will survive. It's a very powerful statement coming from the heart and from the pen of Herzl aimed directly at his audience. He goes on then to what is in many respects the underlying premise behind writing this book as the first strategic step in his campaign. And this ought to remind us of his confrontation with Baron Hirsch, in which Herzl refers to Hirsch as the big Jew of money and himself as the Jew of the spirit. And here's what he writes in the introduction to the Jewish state. No human being is wealthy or powerful enough to transplant a nation from one habitation to another. An idea alone can achieve that. And this idea of a state may have the requisite power to do so. The Jews have dreamt this kingly dream all through the long nights of their history. Next year in Jerusalem is our old phrase. It is now a question of showing that the dream can be converted into a living reality. And indeed, from these majestic heights that he reaches in the introduction, Herzl devotes most of this short book to demonstrating that this dream can be converted into a living reality. And he lays out the structure very clearly. Chapter 2 is on the Jewish question, and here he lays out the problem, principally anti-Semitism, and the solution, creating a Jewish state somewhere in the world where we can control our own destiny. Chapters 3, 4, and 5 are very much a how-to guide to build this state. Chapter 3 on the Jewish company, chapter 4 on the local groups, which are the agents that bring Jews to this new land, and chapter 5 on the Society of Jews. The conclusion deals with objections and ends, I think, with rhetorical power and a call to action, which is precisely what Herzl had intended. What we're now going to do is cover briefly each of these chapters, trying to focus on the central points and how they are meant to achieve the goals that Herzl had for himself and for his movement. So, chapter 2 is in many ways the intellectual heart of Herzl's case, because it's here that he explains the potent force of anti-Semitism, considers the options, and in the end comes down to just one possibility that in his eyes could really work. Here's what he writes. No one can deny the gravity of the situation of the Jews. Wherever they live in perceptible numbers, they are more or less persecuted. Attacks in parliaments, in assemblies, in the press, in the pulpit, in the street, on journeys. For example, their exclusion from certain hotels. Even in places of recreation, become daily more numerous. The forms of persecutions vary according to the countries and social circles in which they occur. I'll just note parenthetically, he knows he's writing not just to the Jews of Western Europe, not just to his own milieu, Listen carefully to how he reaches out. In Russia, imposts are levied on Jewish villages. In Romania, a few persons are put to death. In Germany, they get a good beating occasionally. In Austria, anti-Semites exercise terrorism over all public life. In Algeria, there are traveling agitators. In Paris, the Jews are shut out of the so-called best social circles and excluded from clubs. Shades of anti-Jewish feeling are innumerable. And he leaves the reader with the sense that he could go on and on and on, cataloging anti-Semitism as it exists across the world, but the point is made. And he understood that in this moment, each reader, whatever country he or she was in, was going to say, oh yeah, and in my country it was the pogrom, and in my country it was my neighbor getting pushed out of his job, and in my country it was the anti-Semitic newspapers and intellectual leaders. So he then, having explained here and later in the text that anti-Semitism was a very deep force, laid out the question in the simplest form. Are we to get out now, and where to? Or may we yet remain, and how long? Let us first settle the point of staying where we are. Can we hope for better days? Can we possess our souls in patience? Can we wait in pious resignation till the princes and peoples of this earth are more mercifully disposed towards us? I say that we cannot hope for a change in the current of feeling. And why not? Even if we were as near to the hearts of princes as are their other subjects, they could not protect us. They would only feel popular hatred by showing us too much favor. This is written to all of those Jews who would say, yes, but the emperor, Franz Josef, he sees our plight. Even in Russia, there was a view that said the Tsar's ministers, the secret police, the Russian Orthodox Church, they're a problem. But the Tsar, he understands us. And in country after country, people thought that perhaps the leaders would be more enlightened. And of course, Herzl goes on to explain why it is that the people were so much against the Jews. He doesn't condemn anti-Semitism. He simply notes, this is how it is. This is how it works. We have to live with it. We have to be modern scientific empirical people recognizing patterns that occur time after time after time. So since, as he argues, Jews can't stay where they are, the question is where to? And so he considers the Hirschian possibility of moving people elsewhere. What is achieved by transporting a few thousand Jews to another country? Either they come to grief at once, or they prosper, and then their prosperity creates anti-Semitism. It was very simple for him. Only two choices. Whenever Jews move to an area that didn't have Jews in it, they begin to prosper, in which case anti-Semitism follows as a result of jealousy and competition, or they don't even prosper, in which case there was no point in the experiment to begin with. So he very quickly rules this out, and then lays out his case clearly, just as he had done at the very beginning in the introduction, in the preface. The whole plan is in its essence perfectly simple, as it must necessarily be if it is to come within the comprehension of all. Let the sovereignty be granted us over a portion of the globe large enough to satisfy the rightful requirements of a nation. The rest we shall manage for ourselves. And then, having said that this needs to be a simple plan, lays it out in simple terms. The plan, simple in design but complicated in execution, will be carried out by two agencies, the Society of Jews and the Jewish Company. The Society of Jews will do the preparatory work in the domains of science and politics, which the Jewish Company will afterwards apply practically. The Jewish Company will be the liquidating agent of the business interests of departing Jews and will organize commerce and trade in the new country. Or, in other words, and borrowing from what he writes elsewhere, the Society of Jews will serve as the representative of the Jews to figure out if and to where they are interested in moving to set up this new country of theirs. And it will represent them vis-a-vis other nations in the initial stages. But the nuts and bolts work, really getting into the weeds, that's going to be the work of the Jewish Company. And interestingly enough, Herzl then inverts what we would expect the logic to be, and he begins with the Jewish Company. I think the reason he does so is because he's afraid that if readers go on for too long with a sense, this is nice, this is beautiful, wouldn't it be great if, at a certain point, you can't suspend your disbelief for that long, and they would just lose patience with it or conclude that it's all just a tale. And so he wants them to know from the very outset, this is doable. There are a host of problems. I've thought about all of them. There are solutions to all of them. Maybe I'm wrong on the specific solutions, but the fact that one man can sit down, lay out the problems, and come through with what seems to be a coherent set of proposals indicates that this is something that can be done. And interesting exercise is just to look at the topics that are dealt with. And there seem to be, by my count, 15 of them in this chapter. And they really read like an outline of how to build your very own state. Here's what they are. Non-transferable goods, purchase of land. And as you hear these, picture the steps taken one by one in order to move Jews from where they are in Europe and elsewhere and settle them down in the promised land. So it goes on. After purchase of land, buildings, workmen's dwellings, unskilled laborers, the seven-hour day, relief by labor, commerce, other classes of dwellings, some forms of liquidation, securities of the company, some of the company's activities, promotion of industries, settlement of skilled laborers, method of raising capital. Right, so I admit when I read this the first couple of times, when I read through this chapter, I found it kind of dull because it's so much in depth in how it's going to work here. And since I know how the story turned out and I know that not everything was done quite the way Herzl proposed or imagined it, at first it seemed unnecessary detail, but viewed from the point of view of February of 1896 to people who were thinking, maybe it's a nice idea, but it's impossible, it was the detail that did the work. The fact that somebody could figure out how to do this, and each of the steps really seemed quite plausible. You could argue with it, you could disagree with this or that element, but it made sense. And I think that's what Herzl was trying to achieve in this chapter. From there, he moved on to chapter 4, which is local groups. There's a lot in this chapter, but I want to just focus on one point because of the controversy as to what was Herzl's attitude towards the Jewish religion and towards the leaders of the Jewish religion. And here's what he writes. This is in the context of discussing how local groups, what in the modern terms we would call garinim, groups of Jews who organized together to move as a unit to Israel. He wanted to write about the leadership of those groups, and he did it as follows. Every group will have its rabbi traveling with his congregation. Local groups will afterwards form voluntarily about their rabbi, and each locality will have its spiritual leader. Our rabbis, on whom we especially call, will devote their energies to the service of our idea and will inspire their congregations by preaching from the pulpit. They will not need to address special meetings for the purpose. An appeal such as this may be uttered in the synagogue. As an aside, he's pointing out here, for those of you who think that you can't conduct business in the synagogue and you can only deal with holy work, this is holy work. This is exactly the kind of thing that synagogues were made for. And he goes on, and thus it must be done. For we feel our historic affinity only through the faith of our fathers, as we have long ago absorbed the languages of different nations to an ineradicable degree. Now, there's obviously a pragmatic dimension to this. The rabbis held very significant power throughout the Jewish world, but especially in Eastern Europe, where he knew the main reservoirs of foot soldiers for this enterprise lay. But there's also a very significant statement here. This idea that we feel our historic affinity only through the faith of our fathers is a statement that it's not language that unites us, right? At this time, it was not yet the case that Jews were united by Hebrew. Herzl was not a big fan of Yiddish, and Yiddish in any event was spoken only in certain areas in Europe and much less used in Western Europe and obviously not used in North Africa, and he was aware of that because of his earlier reference that we read to anti-Semitism in Algeria. His point here, then, is that religion really for us is what has kept this flame alive for 2,000 years, and when I said we are a people, one people, I said that because of our religion. Yes, there are other things, but the religion is at the core of it. And I think for those who want to argue that Herzl lacked religious sensibilities or was just a free thinker creating a free thinking state, I think this paragraph is at least a difficulty for them to read. I should note, lest you think that I believe that everything that Herzl did was pure genius and inspired, one of the things he got wrong was about the Hebrew language, where he writes famously, "Who among us knows enough Hebrew to buy a railway ticket?" And of course, at the time, there were very few people who did, but over time, one of the great successes of the Zionist movement was in developing an entire nation of people who know enough to order a railway ticket, and by the way, have a railway and all sorts of other things that accompany it. Now, I want to move on to chapter 5, which is on the society of Jews, which is important in its own right and is also crucial in understanding Herzl's sense of institution building. He begins with laying out the theory of Jean-Jacques Rousseau on the social contract, and then he steps up and argues against one of the giants of modern political theory. We don't have the time to go into that argument, but I would recommend in particular the treatment of it in Yoram Chazoni's The Jewish State, where he makes the case for Herzl as a political theorist on precisely this point. I want to come down, though, where we see Herzl, the former law student and lover of Roman law at the University of Vienna, making the following argument. The Romans, with their marvelous sense of justice, produced that noble masterpiece, the Negotorium Gestio. When the property of an oppressed person is in danger, any man may step forward to save it. This man is the gestor, the director of affairs and not strictly his own. He has received no warrant, that is, no human warrant. Higher obligations authorize him to act. The higher obligations may be formulated in different ways for the state and so as to respond to individual degrees of culture attained by a growing general power of comprehension. The gestio is intended to work for the good of the dominus, the people, to whom the gestor himself belongs. Right? A little bit complicated, he's defining his terms, but he's trying to figure out the question of political theory. How can you form a nation? How can you determine on a reasonable basis for creating a government for a set of people, given that it's hard to imagine that all of the people in an area get together in one moment and decide we are a people and let's create a government. Herzl, as a realist, is trying to understand how it really happens in general and how it might happen in the case of the Jews scattered around the world. So he begins by using this Roman theory, and now he links it to the process of state building, which is the process he's involved in. A state is created by a nation's struggle for existence. In any such struggle, it is impossible to obtain proper authority in circumstantial fashion beforehand. In fact, any previous attempt to attain a regular decision from the majority would probably ruin the undertaking from the outset. Right? So he says, when you're building a nation, you can't just have a vote all the time. You have to have somebody acting in order to get this rolling. Once it's rolling, democracy, republicanism, many options. But at the beginning, you need somebody to step forward. And then he reaches the conclusion that his more thoughtful readers understand he was pushing towards as follows. And how does this all affect our case? The Jewish people are at present prevented by the diaspora from conducting their political affairs themselves. Besides, they are in a condition of more or less severe distress in many parts of the world. They need, above all things, a gestor. This gestor cannot, of course, be a single individual. Such a one would either make himself ridiculous or, seeing that he would appear to be working for his own interests, contemptible. The gestor of the Jews must therefore be a corporate body, and that is the society of Jews. Right? A very simple theory. We can't act as scattered individuals. We need to create a body that represents all Jews and that can act on behalf of the Jews and take the first and decisive step, which is to declare ourselves a people, one people, in search of its own state and ready to negotiate with the powers of the world to bring that along. So he describes how externally the society will attempt to be acknowledged as a state-forming power. The free assent of many Jews will confer on it the requisite authority in its relations with governments. internally, that is to say, in its relation with the Jewish people, the society will create all the first indispensable institutions. It will be the nucleus out of which the public institutions of the Jewish state would later on be developed. Right, so he's pictured the whole thing. He hasn't just pictured the nuts and bolts of the Jewish company, but he's figured, how do you go from here, a people scattered, not able to act as a body, and not recognized as a body by the rest of the world? How can you go from this to a situation where we can be sitting at the table of kings and emperors and prime ministers and leading diplomats from around the world? So he's even given a name to what it is that he's talking about, and he's made it clear that this is going to require that Jewish communities around the world link themselves up to this society of Jews. So he's now laid it out. He laid it out very briefly. I've laid it out even more so. Indeed, this was meant to be the kind of a book, or sometimes in his terminology, a pamphlet, that a person could sit down in a single setting and go from having thought it is neither desirable nor possible to create a Jewish state and come out with the conclusion, you know what? I want this, we need this, and it can really happen. And Herzl closes the book in his conclusion by talking about really what it is he hopes and expects his readers are going to feel in their hearts and do with their pens and their hands and their feet and their voices. And here's what he writes. But we must first bring enlightenment to men's minds. The idea must make its way into the most distant, miserable holes where our people dwell. They will awaken from gloomy brooding, for into their lives will come a new significance. Every man need think only of himself, and the movement will assume vast proportions. And what glory awaits those who fight unselfishly for the cause? And again, you can hear Herzl, that proud Jew who quit Albia because of its anti-Semitism, who wouldn't write something under a pen name because he wanted to continue his father's name. And he really is thinking about the glory that awaits those who fight unselfishly for the cause. Therefore, I believe that a wondrous generation of Jews will spring into existence. The Maccabeans will rise again. Let me repeat once more my opening words. The Jews who wish for a state will have it. We shall live at last as free men on our own soil and die peacefully in our own homes. The world will be freed by our liberty, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness. And whatever we attempt there to accomplish for our own welfare will react powerfully and beneficially for the good of humanity. This last line, by the way, you might recall, this was on one of those scraps of paper that Herzl wrote on in that manic period when he was developing over 10 days his ideas for the Jewish state. And it made it into what was going to be the address to the Rothschilds. And he liked it so much, and correctly so, that he put it at the end of his book. And this is what he wanted his readers to be left with, a call to action. Now, let's sober up a little bit. We're in February 1896. There are 3,000 copies of this book around the world. And we have to understand what Herzl hoped it would accomplish. And then I want to look at what the reactions were. So stepping back and looking at this book in terms of the tripartite challenge, how does it do? What was it aimed to do? Well, first, it was supposed to persuade individuals that a Jewish state was desirable and feasible. And he does this by showing first that it was necessary because of anti-Semitism. We have no choice. The alternative to a Jewish state is continued, perpetual, eternal misery in countries into which we have no way of assimilating and where we simply will never be accepted. So a Jewish state is necessary. A Jewish state is also beneficial. It will end the persecution, it will make us economically better off, and it will lead to a Jewish resurgence. Right? There is, again, that Jewish pride that together we can build something that we haven't been able to do for the last two millennia. And the bulk of the book, of course, is devoted to showing why this is feasible. So on the intellectual side, it at least has the potential to overcome the challenge that was faced. In terms of institution building, there are two big things that the book does. The first one is it is a call for action, and it asks people to join a movement. And there were people who could take up that call, and if they did so, then there might be enough people around Herzl to elevate him to a position of leadership, and more importantly, there might be enough people to start to build and then staff the institutions that would be needed now and in the succeeding decades. So it was a call to bring people into the movement, but he also did something else. This is an outline of what that movement would look like, and as we'll see in subsequent lectures, he goes about founding a society of Jews on this basis, and he goes about trying to follow his blueprint. He learns, he gets criticisms from others, certain things work better and less well, and he improves on that basis, but this really is a blueprint institutionally. So institutionally, he's taking a step and showing what are the next steps. And finally, diplomatically, he's laying the groundwork for organizing the Jews as actors who will get a place or who could get a place at the negotiating table. He is making the case for why the Jewish state is to the benefit of the countries from which the Jews are going to leave, which not incidentally include the Russian Empire and the German Empire, and perhaps in small numbers, because they were there in small numbers, the British Empire. This is an appeal to these and other countries so that they will recognize that they'll be better off if the Jews, or at least many of the Jews from those countries, will move to a Jewish state. And he also makes the case, albeit briefly, that this is going to be great not just for the countries that are rid of their Jews, but for the world as a whole. And that's what that climax of the this talk is about. The world will be freed by our liberty, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness. And whatever we attempt there to accomplish for our own welfare will react powerfully and beneficially for the good of humanity. So at least in potential, if readers are open to Herzl's message, there's a chance that this book will go a long way towards overcoming these obstacles. But let's look at what actually happens, because the majority of people who read this in the West, and I'm referring here particularly to Jews who were the main readers, although by no means the only readers, reacted in the way that Herzl had feared and not in the way that he hoped. So Stefan Zweig, an author whom I quoted earlier for explaining Herzl's position, this was in the second lecture, the particular prestige that Herzl brought to bear, had a clear-eyed view, and this is what he wrote. No man in Vienna was so derided as Herzl was, except perhaps Sigmund Freud, his great brother in fate, who also tried single-handedly to create a grand world concept. Right. Overnight, Herzl went from being the darling of Vienna, the feuilleton editor at the Austro-Hungarian Empire's leading newspaper, to being a man utterly derided for a great worldview that was considered to be entirely fallacious. Alexander Scharf, who was the publisher of a weekly newspaper in Vienna, was asked by somebody, "What would you be prepared to do in order to further Herzl's cause?" And he said the following: "If Herzl should be taken to the lunatic asylum, I shall be glad to put my carriage at his disposal." Classic Viennese wit. Cutting, scathing, but it gets across the point. Of course I'm willing to help. He's a sick man. He needs help. Not only in Vienna were there reactions of this kind, but certainly in the German-speaking world, a Munich newspaper wrote about the Jewish state that it is, quote, an imbecilic prospectus for a Jewish Switzerland on the installment plan. There were views that we should be quite expecting, really, from our discussion of the obstacles to a Jewish state, because one of those was that in liberal circles, this cut against the emancipationist dream. In Orthodox circles, it went against the expectation that it isn't up to us as human beings to determine the end. And this is how a certain Rabbi Bronthal expressed his view to his son, who later recorded it. "Surely the Jewish people will one day return to Palestine, but it will be led there by the grace of God and the Messiah, not by Herr Dr. Herzl of the Neue Freie Presse." Misamcha, who is he? He's not God, and he's not an agent of God. He's a doctor from a particular very Westernized, liberalized milieu. representatives of no fewer than 500 Austro-Hungarian Jewish communities petitioned the empire to outlaw Herzl's Zionism as a godless movement. In England, which you'll recall, the Jewish Chronicle, the paper of record there, had published the summary, and therefore the first work laying out Herzl's ideas, now assigned to one of their writers to assess the full work. And that writer said that the lack of a religious dimension in Herzl's proposal, quote, rendered it cold and comparatively uninviting. And also, this author disapproved of what he referred to as the odious contention that wherever there are Jews, there are anti-Semitism. Right? In England, where the Emancipationist Project was working up ahead of steam, the idea that having Jews there already or bringing in more Jews was going to lead to anti-Semitism was a view that was absolutely anathema. There was a minority view in the West that was more favorable. This will take much less time to read the quotes. Richard Baer Hoffman, who was a poet who himself was seeking to revive Jewish biblical heroes, wrote as follows. At long last, here is a man who carries his Judaism not like a burden or as a disaster in resignation, but as the legitimate legacy of an ancient civilization. Right? Herzl's Jewish pride struck Richard Baer Hoffman's Jewish pride. And of course, there were people like Max Nordau who were already close to Herzl, who were moved by the publication of the work, and there were student circles. Students love radical ideas. Students love things that are countercultural. So there were student groups, including at the University of Vienna, Jewish fraternities that embraced these ideas and invited Herzl to speak. But now let's look at the real big impact of the book in Eastern Europe. Now, there were some people who were negative there, especially those who had already been involved in other efforts to resuscitate Jewish nationalism. So Nachum Sokolov, who later became a disciple of Herzl's, wrote in the Zionist weekly, Hatzfira, under a headline, "Wonderful rumors about the establishment of a Jewish state originating from the mind of a Dr. Herzl." Again, that cutting sarcasm. Right? Wonderful rumors about the establishment of a Jewish state originating from the mind of a Dr. Herzl. Right? This is all somebody's fantasy. And he went on to attack this feuilletonist who dabbles in diplomacy. There's, who is this journalist to come along and say that he can go to the great emperors of the world and build us a state? But generally in Eastern Europe, as Herzl's biographer Amos Alon puts it, Herzl's clarion call, "We are a people, one people," echoed with particular vigor from one corner of the Pale to another. One of the people who heard this clarion call was David Ben-Gurion, the future founding prime minister of Israel, but at this time 10 years old and living in Plansk. And he later recalled that a rumor spread that the Messiah had arrived, a tall, handsome man, a learned man of Vienna, a doctor no less, Theodor Herzl. From the birthplace of Herzl's father, Semlin, there was a man who wrote that all Semlin Jews were ready to emigrate en masse as soon as the Society of Jews was formed. There was a Hasidic rabbi from Poland who wrote that 3 million Hasidim were ready to join Herzl's movement. Perhaps some hyperbole there isn't exactly what happened, but the idea was, we're with you. The East also had its outpost in the West, because there were some of the most promising young people from Eastern Europe made their way to Western universities, especially in Germany. One of those was a great future figure in the Zionist movement, the first president of Israel, and the leading Zionist diplomat for much of the three decades preceding the founding of the State of Israel, Chaim Weizmann. He was at the University of Berlin, and he said that Herzl's tract struck him and his fellow Russian Jewish classmates like a bolt from the blue. "We were enthralled," Weizmann wrote, "by the personality which stood behind these words. Here was daring, clarity, and energy. The very fact that this Westerner came to us unencumbered by our own preconceptions has its appeal." So you can see the world kind of dividing. in response to the initial publication. In the West, largely derision. In the East and in the outposts of the East, there were many Jews who thought this is the great awakening call. This is our opportunity, and this man, Theodor Herzl, might be our leader. Now, the book was translated into other languages, and in fact, within weeks of its publication in German, authorized translations were already being prepared in English, Russian, Yiddish, Hebrew, Spanish, French, and Romanian. So in, at least in the vast majority of communities where Jews lived, with the notable exception here of Arabic, it was going to be possible to read this. Now, it's interesting to look not just at the reaction of people who were touched, but at a distance, or people who made offers in principle to do something. Then we need to look briefly at the reaction of those people, at least a couple of them, for whom this was a transformative experience. And I want to begin with a figure who is described in the most colorful terms, but they apparently fall short of the reality. The Reverend William Hechler, the chaplain to the British Embassy in Vienna, one of these striking figures with the long beard and looking eccentric out of not a previous century, but probably a previous millennium. He came across Herzl's book while in German, because he spoke German, while perusing the shelves in a Viennese bookstore, and opened it up and read it, and came to Herzl unannounced. And when he was ushered in, he said, "I am here." And Herzl looked at him and said, "I see that you are here, but who are you?" And the Reverend Hechler explained that he had long ago predicted a messianic arising of the Jews in this time, around this time of 1896, and he saw Herzl as the fulfillment, and he was going to help him. And he was friendly with the Grand Duke, who was an uncle of the Kaiser in Germany, in the German Empire, and he could get Herzl to the Kaiser. Completely and totally outlandish, unless you know the continuation of the story, which is through his efforts, Herzl actually got not one, but two audiences with the Kaiser and made significant progress, a subject on which we're going to be speaking in the sixth lecture in this series when we talk about Herzl as a diplomat. So he's one of the people who joined the movement and remained a friend and ally of Herzl throughout. Perhaps even more profoundly was the impact on David Wolfson, himself a Jew from Eastern Europe who moved to Cologne in Germany, and became a very successful timber merchant. He actually heard about the book in advance and asked to receive advance page proofs. Even in the day, they had advance page proofs, and if you knew the right people, you could get them. So he got a copy of the book in advance, and he describes the process of reading it. He sat down to read it, and he continued, and it's midnight, and he continued, and he was just utterly gripped by it, page after page. And he finished it at about 1 a.m. and later reported, "I became a new man." Right? The reading of this book transformed him. And he said, "I must go see this man, this Theodor Herzl." En route, it was a pretty long drive and a pretty short book, he read the book over and over. And when he arrived, unannounced, he walked in and said, "I have come to meet the author of The Jewish State and to shake his hand." He went on to tell Herzl that everything depended on the reaction of the Russian Jews, and he wanted to help him with the Russian Jews, and he was of the Russian Jews and really understood them and could be a liaison. And at the end of their conversation, he said to Herzl, "Dr. Herzl, I place myself at your disposal. All that I am and have are yours, unconditionally. I am at your service." And he went on to make good on that, was Herzl's closest and most loyal ally, and actually succeeded him after Herzl's death as the head of the Zionist movement. So we can see the beginning of institution building already. Now, where do we stand at this point? We're a small number of months after the publication of The Jewish State. Herzl has succeeded in becoming hated or derided or scorned or mocked by many, but there are probably more in the East, who who came to love him, saw him as a great leader, as a potential Messiah, as somebody who they should follow, as somebody whose dream they should adopt as their own dream. And perhaps most significantly, we see the beginning of a nucleus forming around Herzl, the people who are willing to make his dream into their dream, and by making it their dream, hope to make it an achievable dream for the Jewish people. But now, Herzl has a dilemma. The book is out, the die is cast, people are coming to him. There's a question about what is the next big deed, what's the next action that needs to be taken. And in our upcoming lecture, we're going to look into the question, what dilemma did Herzl face, what decision did he make, and how did that redound ultimately for the success of the Zionist movement?
Why do you think, this is just going back to the Jewish question analysis that Herzl offers, ultimately there were so many of his colleagues and contemporaries who really did harbor hope for assimilation and thought that the assimilationist path could keep the Jews safe. And he entertained that, was never able to accept that analysis. Why did he think that they were so wrong?
Well, I think he was a very clear-headed person, and he was looking at his own experiences. He had grown up in Pest, which then became Budapest, the capital of the Hungarian part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he ended up leaving his school in large part because of anti-Semitism, and he saw that anti-Semitism all around him in a place that was supposedly bringing progress to that region of the empire. He moved to Vienna, and Vienna was the intellectual capital of Europe. It was the cultural capital. It was a place of tremendous enlightenment, and it was a place with a rapidly burgeoning anti-Semitic movement. Shlomo Avineri, in his superb biography of Herzl, makes the case that what was happening in the Austro-Hungarian Empire in general and in Vienna in particular had this profound impact. You had a figure, Karl Luger, who was rising up in the ranks and ultimately won the election for mayor a number of times until finally the emperor, who didn't want to seat him as mayor, felt compelled to do so. And that was just one of the phenomena there. Herzl then moves from there to Paris, which is the political capital of Europe and a place of tremendous enlightenment and the place of equality and fraternity and all of these other great values. And what he sees is a rising anti-Semitic movement. He sees an entire newspaper devoted to anti-Semitism, and he's realizing that if in these places, which are supposed to be the most enlightened, which are supposed to be the places in which the Jewish project of becoming part of the surrounding society, if in these places it's failing, then surely it's failing in other places as well. And the more he learned about the world and the more he became a Jewish leader, the more he came to understand that anti-Semitism was rife and it didn't seem to be disappearing.
And the proposal to establish a Jewish state, he leaves open the possibility that it may be in the historic land of Israel, it may be elsewhere. Do you think he was agnostic about that? Is there evidence from his writing and journal that he had more committed feelings toward one location or the other?
At this stage, I think he did not yet have those feelings. You can see certain things in his diaries and in his other writings about it, and he certainly had more of an emotional attachment to the land of Israel than he did to the land of Argentina. But he wanted a piece of territory where the Jews could be sovereign, and he was deeply concerned about opposition of the people already there. And so Argentina, from his point of view, had a more sparse population than the land of Israel, than Palestine did, and that made it more attractive. I think he also had an understanding of how politics works. If your heart is set on only one place, then your ability to negotiate is much more limited because it's then expected you'll do anything for that place. Whereas if you have different alternatives, you're in a better bargaining position. Also, if he set all the hopes on Palestine and then it just turned out that the Ottoman Empire wouldn't budge and the German Empire, the Russian Empire, and the British Empire, which potentially had the clout to change the Sultan's view, wouldn't use that clout, then what's he going to do? Declare the bankruptcy of his movement? And the logic of his movement was that he had to keep more than one option open. And he kept more than one option open. Having said that, as time went on, he became more and more attached to Palestine. And it was an imponderable, it was what really stirred the Jewish dreams. And the more he met Russian Jews, and they told him why his message resonated so much with them, the more he understood that the land was a big part of it and not just the sovereign state.
So, do you think that Herzl expected the tremendous resonance of this book in Eastern Europe, the way that it actually, in the lecture you tell us, it came to pass?
I don't think he had enough of an appreciation of Eastern European Jewry to expect this kind of a torrent. Now, there were moments when he thought he would become the intellectual leader of hundreds of thousands of people, and where he could picture himself taking a leading role as the Jews on their ships came into Palestine, or came into the Promised Land. But from what we know, he didn't have a very profound knowledge of Eastern European Jewry. He gained that over time, and you see it in his diary. As he meets with individuals like David Wolfson or Menachem Ussishkin, as he starts traveling in areas east of his normal stomping grounds, we'll call them, and he's stunned because he'll stop at a railway station and in the middle of the night, hundreds or thousands of Jews will come out and they'll greet him as the Messiah. And on the one hand, he's very uncomfortable with it, and he feels like he's already becoming a legend and he's already becoming this kind of cloudy, ethereal figure and not the real-life human being. But at the same time, he has an appreciation that he has stirred his people's soul in a way that he hadn't anticipated. One of the great stories of Theodor Herzl is the story of learning. He is not the same person after he puts out his book that he was before, because he's learned in the process. And he's not the same person after the first Zionist Congress than he was before, because he's learned from the people and from the challenges and from his mistakes and from the things he got right. He learned a tremendous amount about the Jewish world as a result of his activism on behalf of the Jews. And I think the lessons he gained in Eastern Europe were an absolutely essential part of that.